versus Commonwealth. Mr. Pachuca and Ms. Ford.
May it please the court. I'm Larry Pachuca. I represent John Dixon O'Malley.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes would be fine. This is a case that deals with the interpretation of Virginia Code Section 3.2-6540. We've alleged five elements of assignment of errors, denial of the motion to...
Well, let me interrupt you and maybe take you out of order a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Assignment of error number three is essentially you're asserting or arguing that this is a civil proceeding rather than a criminal proceeding.
Yes, sir.
And if that's the case, why are we here? Why aren't you in the Supreme Court?
Well, I had understood that if you filed it in the wrong court, that it would be transferred to the court that was...
Well, that's true. We will certainly transfer it, but, I mean, if it's in the wrong court, there's no point in us hearing oral argument, is there?
Well, it was decided as a criminal matter in the circuit court.
But if that's wrong, which is what your position is, then the appeal would lie with the Supreme Court, wouldn't it?
Because it would be a civil matter rather than a criminal case.
And it's not one of the civil cases that the Supreme Court has enumerated in our jurisdiction.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, but my position was, my theory was, that since it had been ruled to be a criminal case, that it would go forward in this court until it's a criminal case. And if I had filed in the wrong court, that I understand
well,
the way
if
it works.
Filed, if the Supreme Court thought it was criminal, they'd transfer it here. But either way... we don't need to reach the merits, do we, until we resolve the issue of whether it's civil or criminal?
In terms of the jurisdiction of the court having decided the case.
Right.
It's a confusing matter to me, Your Honor.
It
makes it a long case even longer.
Well, I mean, that's the obvious place to start. That's why I wanted to take you out of order, because clearly if we have no jurisdiction, and nothing either party says has any meaning unless it's said in the right court.
And the resolution at this point would be then to transfer it to the Supreme Court, I understand.
Well, in the event we disagree and determine we do, I guess we can get to the merits, but your assignment of error number one, which refers to the Richmond ordinance, your client was not charged under any ordinance. He was charged under state law. So why do we care what the
state law
or anybody else has to say on the subject?
The state law incorporated and made the local laws a part of the state law. It's not a matter of a conflict. It's a matter of the section 3.26540M, which states...
All that does is give the authority of the localities to adopt parallel ordinances if they choose to, doesn't it?
That's correct. And the parallel, but it makes that a part of the statute. So what the locality has done in reliance upon that statute is, I would assume, binding upon the state as well. The question is what's...
Well, I mean, it really comes down to a matter of money. I don't think there's any secret that the reason localities can adopt ordinances similar to state law is it determines who gets the fine money and the cost money. But the bottom line is to the extent state law conflicts with a local ordinance, state law controls, doesn't it?
It does if it conflicts, but it's the duty of the court to harmonize those if they can.
Well, no, but I mean, the prosecutor gets to elect. If you have two or more statutes that might apply, the prosecutor ordinarily gets to use their discretion to determine whether, for example, proceed under driving under the influence under the state code or driving under the influence under the Richmond City Code.
That's if two apply. Yes, sir,
and,
I agree.
Seems to be the argument here is that the Richmond Ordinance applies but wasn't used, and I guess my first question is, so what?
No, sir. But the argument here, that's what the Commonwealth argues. But the appellant's argument is that pursuant to the very words in the statute itself, that statute makes the decision of the locality, gives the locality the right to pass a law which is incorporated into that statute, and then it thereby becomes the enforcement of the state statute. It's only one portion of the actual statute which the locality has the authority to determine, and that's on a parallel matter. But the rest of the statute really becomes, it's still the state statute. The locality just has the right to pass a parallel law, just as they did here, finding that a dog which bit another dog is not to be determined a dangerous animal. And that's consistent with the way this statute, the history of the statute, because from 1993 until 2006, the localities had the authority to make all these decisions regarding dangerous dogs, and it was changed in 2006.
If your argument is correct, it seems to be carried to its logical extreme. What you seem to be suggesting is that the General Assembly gave each of the various localities the authority to modify the elements of either the criminal or civil, depending on how you look at it, statute
yes,
here involved here. So that what might be a crime in Richmond is not a crime in Virginia Beach or Tazewell County or Alexandria. Is that seriously what you're suggesting?
It is, because that's exactly the way the...
Can you point to the language you rely on to for that conclusion?
Well, it's 3.26540M, which gives the locality the authority to adopt a local ordinance.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's giving the locality the authority to change the elements of the state law, is it? Does it?
It depends on what parallel. It depends on how you interpret parallel. And if you look at the statute that was in existence prior to this time, each of the localities had the right to do that. And it seems that what had occurred in 2006 when this was amended was that at that time there was an effort to preserve what had been done before. And that would be the intent of the statute. And in order to find the intent of the statute, I would suggest that the court needs to look at what the statute was from 93 to 2006 and the reasons that it was changed and the manner in which it was changed. And the earlier statute from 2006 gave every locality the right to pass these statutes.
Well, I mean, it's not uncommon. For example, as I just mentioned, for example, localities have the right to adopt an ordinance that punishes driving under the influence of alcohol, or reckless driving, or, you know, all manner of traffic violations. That doesn't mean they're changing any of the state law's elements that have to be proved. It simply allows the locality to adopt a congruent ordinance and that have exactly the same elements. So, and to the extent a locality doesn't do that, adopts an ordinance that's inconsistent with the statute, there's plenty of precedent out there that says those are void.
Right, but those are all separate statutes. What we have here is the interpretation of one specific statute that when it was enacted, it said that this statute is going to apply in this fashion throughout the state. But if a locality wants to change this statute, not have their own statute, but change this statute, because that's what...
You read all that from the word parallel?
Well, what else could the Section M mean? I would say that what Section M means is that the locality has the right to make some determinations about, and we're talking about a dangerous dog. I mean, so you're not talking about driving under the influence. You're talking about a very specific matter under which localities may have definite interests that conflict with one another. And it's not separate statutes. It's the state statute that is fashioned through the paragraph M to make it applicable to the local, to the locality.
May I change course here for just a minute?
Yes, ma'am.
With your assignment of error number two, can you tell me where in the appendix record is the jury instruction that you proffered and you say was refused?
I would say a joint appendix number 16 and the reference to the instruction that was copied word for word into the appellant's brief is incorrect. And as I recalled what occurred with that, that was a draft that I had. And then we got there and at the conclusion of the case tried to make it more palatable to the Commonwealth. And the instruction 16 is the one that was finally offered to the court and rejected. And that's the instruction that we rely upon.
You say it's at page 16? Of the appendix?
Of the joint appendix, yes. Yes, ma'am.
Page 16, okay.
It has instruction number A. It's rejected at the bottom.
Okay.
And that, I mean, and that goes to the issue of assignment of error number five, really, the sufficiency of evidence. The jury in this case was not at all required to exclude other good cause from the instruction that was given on that matter, which is at pages 12 and 13, which really confused the issue of what the burden of proof was there. So the really, the way this instruction reads, after you read the first page of it, the jury's has no choice, based on the evidence, but to enter a dangerous dog finding.
Mr. Pachuca, you're getting into your rebuttal time. You can use it or
nope.
Reserve it.
Yes, I'll reserve it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Boyd.
May it please the Court. My name is Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia. My guess to reach your first issue about...
Good, because I was going to ask you about it anyway.
The jurisdiction. Well, you know, under Settle, this issue came up under Settle.
Well, exactly. And what did the Supreme Court do with
it? It remanded it back to this court to decide.
And you know how they did that?
With an unpublished
order.
Yes, I do.
So we have no precedent. We have Rafferty,
yes.
Which it seems to me is right on point because Settle relied on Rafferty and... Properly so, I think. But so Rafferty is apparently good law, and it seems to me the only distinction that I can see between the refusal statute involved in Rafferty and the statute involved in Settle and the statute involved here is the language, if I can find it quickly, along the lines of the procedure for appeal and trial shall be the same as provided by law for misdemeanors. And so it comes down to whether the term procedure equals the term jurisdiction. And I'm not sure that they do, because I think there's jurisprudence to the effect that procedure doesn't convey jurisdiction.
Well, I mean, except that, Your Honor, what I would say is that this very same issue came up in Settle, and then it was remanded, and this court had to decide Settle.
Without any rationale, and that's my problem, is, the only precedent that's currently out there is Rafferty, which is what Settle relied upon. So the Supreme Court did not, in their unpublished order, overrule themselves in Rafferty. They just did nothing except reverse Settle without comment.
Implicitly state that this court had jurisdiction by sending it back.
But how do you get there from here? The Supreme Court of Virginia can't convey jurisdiction. Only the General Assembly can convey jurisdiction, with all due respect to my colleagues upstairs. So the General Assembly has conveyed jurisdiction in 17.1 when they created the Court of Appeals. And its civil jurisdiction is very limited. The civil jurisdiction of this court is very limited. If this is a civil case, then... It has to, it seems to me, fit within one of the civil categories in that statute. If it's a criminal case, then we probably don't have anything to talk about. So is this a criminal case or is this a civil case?
This is it is to be tried as if it is a misdemeanor, which is a criminal case, by that language in the statute, saying that the procedures that apply will be the same procedures that apply in a misdemeanor case. It has conferred jurisdiction both to the trial court to use criminal procedure and to this court, I would argue, to hear a criminal appeal of a misdemeanor.
That's quite true as far as the procedure is concerned, but as my learned colleague Judge Clemens pointed out in Settle and as the Supreme Court pointed out in Rafferty, if the General Assembly had intended for it to be a criminal case, they simply would have said, it's a misdemeanor. You'd, instead of saying, treat it like a misdemeanor, apply a misdemeanor burden of proof and apply misdemeanor procedures, they could have simply said, it's a misdemeanor. And that would have been the end of it. But in calling it something else, it arguably indicates it's a civil matter but with criminal procedure overtones to it. And the question then still gets back to, does that equate to a conveyance of jurisdiction by the General Assembly as opposed to a conveyance of jurisdiction by the Virginia Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, I've answered the question the only way that I think I can answer the question, which is that this is what happened the last time we had this very, very same issue come up, and I think the very same language. I I mean, I suppose that if the court does not believe it has jurisdiction, then it can be sent up to the Supreme Court, and they will probably send it back, and the same thing will happen again. But, I mean, that's sort of where we are.
That may be what happens, because I'm not sure. I'm not sure we have a whole lot of guidance otherwise. Maybe the next time around they'll give us some guidance.
Okay, well, I would like to move on to the other issues, because I don't think that there's any other way to answer that question, given the procedural posture where we are and the cases that are controlling, I think, at this point. With regard to the whether or not the Richmond City Code did not authorize this, now, of course, the issue here is that preemption works one way, and that is that a city ordinance cannot preempt a state statute. And nothing in the language of this statute confers jurisdiction to the city council to be able to change the meaning of the statutory language in this case. And so for those reasons, this is a matter of prosecutorial discretion. The prosecutor here clearly decided to charge under the state statute. It doesn't matter whether or not the language is contained within this statute or in some separate statute. It is a parallel. It gives permission to give a parallel ordinance, but it does not confer jurisdiction to preempt the state statute. With regard to the instruction, the problem here is we still don't know what instruction was proffered to the court. And he has proffered that it was this instruction number A, but there is language crossed out, language written in that is then crossed out. And so the complaint, from my understanding, is that the instruction didn't address good cause. However, instruction number 4 did address good cause, and the instruction that he's proffered, instruction number A, any reference to good cause is scratched out. So even if that was, it's unclear to me in what form that was proffered to the court, because there are things crossed out.
Is there a 5A18 issue regarding this assignment?
Yes, I mean, to the extent that, I think that there are three issues, really. First of all, it's unclear from the record what he has proffered and in what form. It is his burden on appeal to make a complete record for this court. And if he has failed to do so, then this matter cannot be reversed on that issue. In addition to that, it's unclear that this argument was preserved under 5A18. And because when you look at page 16 of the joint appendix, and where this argument took place, it's unclear what particular instruction was actually proffered. The third issue is that there is nothing improper about the instruction that was given. It actually parallels what the statute states. And so for all of those reasons, I would argue that there is no problem with the instruction, which of course was an abuse of discretion standard, and given that the instruction paralleled what the statute stated, there was no abuse of discretion. I think we've talked about whether this is civil or criminal to the extent that we can. I mean, one of the issues is that I would note is that he hasn't, he says, well, the court erred in saying that this was a civil case, but the only issue he identified as being a problem was whether or not he could get interrogatories. And the statute is clear that criminal procedures are to be used here. So that's really not an issue, because you don't get interrogatories under criminal procedure. So the only issue that he's preserved for appeal, I would say, is answered by the plain language of the statute. With regard to the admissibility of the evidence, the standard is abuse of discretion. And whether or not there is a city ordinance that differs from the state statute is not an appropriate evidence to be in front of the jury. because in essence, he's not asking the jury to decide this matter on the facts of the case, but on someone else's opinion, which is not relevant to what the issue is here, and is confusing for the jury. And on the issue of sufficiency of the evidence, the issue was not plainly wrong here. The decision was not plainly wrong. This was a dog that attacked another dog and inflicted serious injury. And so for those reasons, I would ask that you affirm unless you have other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chuka?
In regard to the preservation of the objection to the instruction at page 114, starting at line 12 of the transcript, the court says, I'm not going to give this. I'll give the statute one. I've typed it like this. The changes are subject to the exceptions of some of the language in there. It is basically the statute. I'm going to give the good cause definition. I think it's reasonable and makes sense and gives them something to base it on. They have no guidance. My response, Judge, this instruction basically directs a verdict. It doesn't have any reference to good cause. The court, look at it, read the whole thing. It says subject to the exceptions that follow. And my response, where is the element of good cause? The court, subject to the exceptions that follows. The Commonwealth's attorney, I was just going to insert that. The court, there are two pages to that instruction. My response, I only have one. The Commonwealth is in your other hand. Myself, I was confused. I was. The court, I understand why you were confused, but the way it was drawn, I didn't have a secretary to type it up. And my response, the problem, it occurs to me, it doesn't place a burden on the Commonwealth to eliminate good cause. The court, that was your objection previously, and you put it on the record, overruled. Exception is noted. I would suggest to the court that that is a sufficient determination that I objected to instruction number 4 and objected to the rejection of instruction number 8 that's in there. So the idea that that issue hasn't been preserved is contrary to the transcript that I just read. And when you talk about the sufficiency of the evidence, this is a case where there was a driving snowstorm, neighbors from across the street. My client owned two dogs. Miss O'Malley went to brush the dogs off, take them inside, as she'd done numerous times before. And they went across the street where this other neighbor was walking his dog. There was one bite. The owner of the dog reached down and was able to extract that dog immediately. The dog that was bitten, although there was a fairly lengthy cut in, healed in 2 weeks. And the dog was under question, Raven, that was determined to be a dangerous dog, 6 years old, never had bitten another dog. The evidence is that it was taken to dog parks and subject to voice commands of other folks. That's certainly good cause not to find this dog to be a dangerous dog. And to the extent whether it's a civil burden or a criminal burden, the evidence did not prove that this was a dangerous dog in accordance with the statute.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll come down and recounsel.